Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the director of the Institute, and welcome to Bligh Street for this, our first Sydney event of 2019. Let me especially welcome, I think we have consuls general today from the United States, Japan, Fiji, the Philippines, and Switzerland, among other countries. And today I'll be talking with this very talented panel of colleagues about the big issues that will affect Australia and the world in 2019. There are a few things coming up, ladies and gentlemen. 2019 may see, or will see, the end game of the Brexit saga, maybe. The 2020 presidential campaign hotting up. On the Democratic side, we have declared candidates in Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, Tulsi Gabbard, Julian Castro, and some others, possible candidates including Beto O'Rourke and Joe Biden, who of course spoke to the Institute a few years ago. We have elections in Indonesia, Afghanistan, India, the Solomon Islands, and Canada. We have an Australian federal election coming up, probably in May, that will have significant implications for our place in the world. Populists continue to wield power in the United States, Brazil, the Philippines, Italy, and elsewhere. Financial markets showing some signs of nervousness. A trio of global risks to the international economy in Brexit, the US-China trade war, and a possible slowdown in Chinese growth. India overtaking the UK to become the world's fifth largest economy, and cracks widening, I think it's fair to say, in the facade of the liberal international order. So we're in for an interesting year. I can't promise we will get to all of those topics, but we're going to try to cover as many as we can. And we have a terrific panel of outstanding Institute experts. From my left, we have Richard McGregor, former Financial Times columnist and journalist, I should say, in Washington, in Beijing, in Shanghai, and around the world. Next, we have Ben Bland, who is our newly arrived Southeast Asia project director. I dragooned Ben in today when I read his excellent column in the AFR on Indonesian elections and decided he must join us. Ben joined us only a couple of weeks ago and has hit the ground running with op-eds in the AFR, the Nikkei Asia Review, The Interpreter, and elsewhere. So very warm welcome to you. We have Roland Raja, our program director for the international economy, who served as an Australian official in Indonesia. And to my left, we have Alex Oliver, who oversees as research director our entire research output, but is also an expert in her own right on public opinion and diplomacy, among other topics. So please join me in welcoming my colleagues. So I'm going to, first of all, give everybody 2 minutes, which I will police with alacrity, 2 minutes to talk about one issue for 2019 that they think is going to be important and we should all watch. I'm going to kick off with you, Alex.
Right, that's tough, but obviously we have an election coming up. It looks like it's going to be in May, and foreign policy doesn't usually feature strongly in Australian public opinion, but this one might be a little bit different, judging by the cascade of major speeches on foreign policy late last year, sort of setting the stage for an interesting election in some of the elements will be about foreign policy. I'm just going to preface a few, so we can talk about it later in more detail if anybody's interested, but there seems to have been a furious agreement between both parties on the importance of the Pacific in Australian foreign policy, and perhaps a tacit agreement on the role of China in the Pacific. And that will, I think, probably not play out in public opinion, but it will be very interesting to watch in terms of the next Australian federal government. On the other issues, foreign policy issues that could possibly raise their heads in an election, I think the parties are pretty bipartisan. There's no serious disagreement on the US alliance. Bill Shorten called it a pillar of our foreign policy in a speech to the Institute late last year. On national security, there's little discernible difference. 2% of GDP defence spending, which is agreed by both sides. On diplomacy, particularly in the Pacific, no major disagreement. Quite a sharp disagreement on Jerusalem, but I don't think the election is going to be decided on that unless you're talking about the Wentworth electorate. On China and Indonesia, there's little difference. On aid, there is a big difference, and that is something that we can possibly talk about, given that this government has cut the aid budget quite dramatically since 2013. And on climate, that is an issue that will become an election issue, clearly, with a marked difference between the two parties, particularly on energy policy.
Terrific. Thank you. Roland, what's your one issue you want to kick off with?
For me, it's very hard to go past the US-China trade war. And, of course, the near-term issue is whether or not we'll get a deal by March 1 in order to avoid an escalation in tariffs between the two. I think watching the reports on the negotiations, you have to say it's all looking pretty tenuous. There's some decent progress around the easy issue of China basically buying more US stuff in an effort to try and buy down the size of the bilateral trade deficit, which is, of course, something that Donald Trump cares a lot about. But in terms of the structural issues around market access for trade and investment to the Chinese economy, around the protection of foreign intellectual property and technology, and around China's use of industrial policies, particularly the Made in China 2025 policy, the progress there looks much more limited. And so to me, what this says is that it's very unlikely by March 1, I think this is pretty clear, that we are going to get a deal that fundamentally resolves the dispute in one fell swoop. That seems very unlikely. That means we're either looking at no deal and an immediate escalation in tariffs, or if there is a deal, in my view, it's more likely to look like an extension of the current tariff truce, with China making some initial concessions, but the United States insisting on an ongoing process for further negotiations around more detailed regulatory issues, which, from a practical perspective, they'll never get to anyway by March 1. As well as ongoing monitoring and verification to ensure that China is in fact living up to its end of the bargain, which the US has been very clear is a very important issue from their perspective. So then the question is whether China can really sign up to something like that, which really looks in some sense like it's being dictated to by a foreign power. There's a question of whether or not the two sides can actually meet somewhere in the middle for some initial agreement around some initial concessions on structural issues. They still look very far apart. China denies the existence of some of the issues, for instance, and the US, for its part, has been very unclear about what exactly it wants, particularly regarding the role of the state in the economy. On top of that, you have to add the broader deterioration in the relationship between the two, as well as all the problems around Huawei, and you have to think that all of these things are going to weigh on against the odds of a deal come March 1. But I think one way or another, this is going to hang over the global economy for the
year
ahead. All right,
so no breakout of peace in the trade wars. let me ask Ben. Alex talked about the Australian election, which is due, we think, in May. There's another great Indo-Pacific election coming up in the next few months to our north. Talk to us about the Indonesian election, if you will. What do you think is going to happen and what's at stake?
Yeah, ostensibly the Indonesian election, which takes place on April 17th at the presidential level, is a rerun of what we saw in 2014. So you have the incumbent Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi, going up against Prabowo Subianto, this former special forces general. He's a bit of a populist, has a hot temper. It looks like a rerun. Jokowi seems to be well ahead in the polls, and he has all the advantages of incumbency, which in Indonesia, in its short democratic history, seems to be important, as well as other electoral systems around the world. So he seems to be ahead, but last time he was far ahead, and Jokowi campaigned very badly against Prabowo, so he lost a lot of his lead and sort of just managed to scrape over the line in the end. So it looks like Jokowi's ahead. The bigger question, I think, is what does this mean for Indonesia and its relationships with other countries around the world, the Indonesian economy? I think this is really another one of those moments to look at the consolidation of Indonesian democracy. It's now 21 years since the fall of Suharto. And, you know, we're looking at a system which seems to be bedding in terms of the process. I just want to sort of give a couple of stats about the election. There's 190 million voters. So this is effectively the biggest direct presidential election in the world, because the US obviously has electoral colleges. Indonesia votes in one day, and it also has simultaneous elections this time for the first time for the Senate, the Parliament, and hundreds, if not thousands, of local assemblies. So you have 300,000 candidates running for office on April the 17th. That's two times the population of Darwin, I believe, just to the south. So this is a huge exercise in organized democracy, and Indonesia does have a really good reputation in the past for organizing free and fair polls. So to that extent, I think it's a good sign. We're likely to see a well-run election. The bigger question is, what does it mean for democracy in Indonesia in terms of quality? And there were some signs that Jokowi was backsliding on protection of minority rights, some signs that he wasn't really upholding democratic principles, and also on economic questions, I think. The Indonesian economy, and I think Roland can speak to this more later, has been bumbling along at about 5% growth. The government hasn't done much to tackle inequality, and both candidates have sort of spoken about these issues, but there's been almost no policy yet so far in a sort of typical personality election. So I think it looks like it's going to be a good year for the organizational aspects of Indonesian democracy, but a lot of big questions about whether either of the candidates really is up to the task of taking on the big structural challenges that always hang over Indonesia.
And just to ask one quick follow-up, what's your quick take on Jokowi as president in his first term? We know that Mr. Turnbull had a kind of a bromance with Jokowi. He's an attractive character to Western eyes, but what about closer to the game? Is he regarded as a success in his first term or not?
I think he's had a really mixed track record. Part of the reason he was seen as exciting in Indonesian outsiders is because he was an outsider. He was a small town businessman who became a mayor, then he was governor of Jakarta, and he jumped to the top office really quickly without anyone working out what he was really about and without him being able to work out what he was about too. So there was a lot of hope put in him, a bit like the Obama syndrome and the fact that he actually only very slightly resembles Obama physically. So he was a bit of a blank check. And he allowed people to think he was whatever they wanted him to be. To some Indonesian liberals, he was the guy who would defend Christians and minority groups. To some Western foreign investors, he was the guy who would finally reform the economy and get rid of protectionist policies. So he's really been a sort of big tent leader. He hasn't pushed hard on any of the tough reforms against vested interests, particularly on the economic front. And he's had a tendency to flip-flop on issues from the release of the jihadi preacher Abu Bakar Bashir recently to economic issues before. So he'll try and do something. If he's criticized, he steps back. And in that respect, I think he's rather more similar than he would like to admit to Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, the previous Indonesian president, who also had this big tent approach. He tried to do some big reforms, but he was scared of upsetting the apple cart, upsetting the fragile political balance. So I think he hasn't done a bad job. He's seen as being personally clean, but he has allowed those around him to enrich themselves. And there are a lot of question marks about whether he's really up to the task. But the other question is, who's he up against, right? And I think Prabowo hasn't done much so far to show that he has better ideas for fixing the economic problems or that he is a better steward for, you know, the young, vibrant democracy that is Indonesia.
Richard, what's your pick for the issue that you think is most interesting and worthy of attention?
Well, you've asked me to speak initially about the US, and I think in the US for the start of this year, we're not going to be looking so much at Trump as Robert Mueller, the Mueller investigation, the special counsel, who was tasked with looking at the issue of alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia in the 2016 poll. So far, it's been a remarkable inquiry. We've had literally dozens of indictments. Former campaign manager of Trump, the former national security advisor of Trump, lately Roger Stone, he's one of his confidants. Soon we might get one family member, one of the Trump sons, who thinks he's going to be indicted. Lots of other campaign operatives as well who've been caught up in it. I think I saw a figure the other day, Obama 8 years in office, zero indictments, Trump a little over 2 years, 90. At least 2 years to go.
That's
a big win. In coming months, I think we're going to get new charges. We're going to see some sentencing. I think Paul Manafort, the campaign manager, will be up before the judge in February and is likely to go to jail. There's the issue of whether Trump will be personally interviewed by Mueller. So far, he's refused that. He's only given written answers. If the special counsel does want to interview him, that'll probably go to the Supreme Court, or at least be tested in court. The big issue, of course, is collusion. Now, there's obviously already evidence of collusion between aspects of the campaign and the Russians, the famous meeting in Trump Tower. Now, that may not have amounted to much, but as once somebody said, even incompetent collusion is collusion. The issue, though, is the pinnacle, the core issue is about Trump and the Russians. And I don't think we're really any wiser about that. And that's going to be the big issue that Mueller will be looking at in his report to the Department of Justice. And of course, we don't know, because Trump now has his operatives in as Attorney General, whether we'll see that immediately. But I figure one way or another, because of the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives, we will get to see his report. We don't have timing for it yet either.
All right. Okay, thank you. So we've had an opening salvo from the colleagues. I'm going to ask them a couple of questions about big countries that I think are interesting, and I'll interrogate them for probably about 15 or 20 minutes, and then I'm going to go to the audience and give you all a chance. So please start thinking now what you would like to ask. Let me start where we finished on the United States and ask a couple of questions on the US, seeing as Mr. Trump is always good for business and people always interested in hearing about the United States. But let me, rather than asking about Mr. Trump first, let me ask about the other side of politics, Richard, Democratic side. I mentioned in my opening a list of some of the candidates who for the Democratic nomination for president, a lot of exciting and interesting and different characters, a lot of other unorthodox characters in Democratic politics, like AOC, who is not eligible to run for president as she's too young and too good with Instagram and Twitter, but a lot of energy on the Democratic side of politics, and also, of course, a new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. So talk to us a bit about Democratic politics, if you would.
Yeah, so the Mueller investigation automatically leads to this issue of possible impeachment. That's a function undertaken by the House. We have a new House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. In my view, from my time in Washington, she's a very underestimated and often dismissed figure. She's often dismissed as a sort of a carbon cutout left winger from California, and underestimated as well for her sort of parliamentary abilities in Congress. By the way, the US is the only country in the world where the word parliamentary is used as a swear word. Anyway, so the important thing about Nancy Pelosi is to think she's not really a Californian. She learned her skills. Her father was the mayor of Baltimore. So she learned from a very young age how to count votes, how to corral constituencies and all that. And Obama would have never got anything done if it weren't for her. Even when she lost the majority of the Democrats lost the majority in the House, she saved the Republicans many times because her counterpart, the Republican Speaker, John Boehner, couldn't get a majority himself in his own caucus. So she's not to be underestimated. She already bested Trump on the wall issue. And she's the key if we get to the issue of impeachment. And so far, I think wisely she said, you know, we're not there yet. But she's the most important Democrat for the moment. Obviously, we're getting this sort of a huge gaggle of potential candidates. You mentioned some of them. I actually wrote a list down. I have to refer to it. Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, Elizabeth Warren, Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard, maybe Joe Biden and Senator Sanders, Sherrod Brown from Ohio, Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, John Hinkenlooper from Colorado, Pete Buttigieg. I checked that, how to pronounce that first. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Maybe Mike Bloomberg, maybe John Kerry. He's talking about it. So a phenomenal number of potential candidates with two big dividing lines which crisscross each other, age and also ideology. The Democratic Party is moving left, maybe not as far as the Republicans have moved right. So it's almost impossible to see where they're going to end up, who will end up with as a candidate, and where they will stand on the ideological spectrum. And a big choice whether to go for somebody younger or older, tried and tested. Now, the Democrats used to laugh at the Republicans when in the Obama elections, because you had a sort of, you know, crazy cartoon sort of a collection of people up on the stage, you know, 10 or 12 people in debates. Well, the Democrats are going to have that now. And that sort of generational change can take a number of years to work through, more than one cycle. Mm. So I guess the end answer of that is that if Trump runs again at the moment, no predictions, but he'd have to be the favourite.
The Republicans will also have a sort of cartoonish figure on their side in the debates, but it's limited to one individual. Mm. Can I ask Alex, what are Australians making of the United States at the moment?
It's a really good question, because initially in the lead up to the 2016 presidential elections, we got some really strong results about Australians turning off the United States and being and really being quite unhappy with the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency. But in the last 2 years, that has evened out. And in fact, Australians are still very strongly supportive of the US alliance. While they initially thought, or they expressed to us in our polls, that that Australia should distance itself from the United States under a potential Trump presidency, that has also stabilised. And now the majority of Australians say, no, we should remain close to the US regardless of who is president. Sentiments towards the US remain very warm. There is a slightly declining trend, but we're only talking about 4 points since the high of the Obama presidency. And it's actually higher than it was during the latter years of the George W. Bush presidency. And sentiments towards the alliance, as I've said, have remained really firm. And in the 16 years of our polling, we have never once fallen, seen a level below 90% of Australians who say that the alliance is either very fairly, extremely very or fairly important for Australia's security. So in all of the essentials, the relationship looks really strong. Where we got a couple of warning signs were in two results last year, a polling which was taken in March and which released in June, as we always do. And that is in trust. And there was a sharp decline in trust in the United States, where the number of Australians who trust the United States to act responsibly in the world a great deal, so the highest response actually halved from 40 to 20. And overall, the response was also significantly down. Now, we trust the United Kingdom the most. 90% of Australians trust the United Kingdom. By comparison, only 55% of Australians trusted the United States last year to act responsibly in the world. And in fact, it was only between India and China in those results. And the other issue is in confidence in leaders. So this is starting to bring in the personalities. And Donald Trump, unsurprisingly, scored pretty low on this measure. Australians have very little confidence in Donald Trump to do the right thing regarding world affairs. We have a lot of trust in people like Theresa May, Shinzo Abe, Malcolm Turnbull scored well, Emmanuel Macron. Even Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi scored higher in trust than Donald Trump. And in fact, the only two leaders who scored lower on this measure were Putin and Kim Jong-un. So he's not in great company down there in the bottom of the our list of nine leaders we polled on. And it might be an interesting question to revisit this year to see whether that's shifted. So there are the indications, I guess early indications, that maybe 2 years of the Trump presidency has seen a slight, but only very slight, erosion in trust in the United States and certainly in confidence in its president.
And let me just give a quick add, and that is that I met with the polling team yesterday and we're finalising the questions now for this year's poll, and it's going to be a cracker, so keep an eye open for that in June. Roland, let me ask you two questions. First of all, about the US economy. How's it faring at the moment and sort of 18 months before the presidential election? And then let me ask you, to go to the other side of the ocean, ask you about the Chinese economy. There's a lot of bearishness out there about the Chinese economy and slowdown in growth. How do you see the Chinese economy?
Okay, so starting first with the United States. So the US economy is doing much better than most of the rest of the world in terms of where it is in its cycle. But basically, it's at the peak of the cycle now, and widely it's expected to slow down from here. And the key part of the story is that the Trump tax cuts, which have really been juicing up the US economy in a short-term cyclical sense over the past year, that effect is still there, but it's going to start fading over the next 12 to 18 months, right in time for the election. So the US economy is on a slowdown trajectory, a cyclically slowing down trajectory, and the problem then is once you take away the temporary sugar hit from the tax cuts, you're left with, what are you left with? You're left with a larger fiscal deficit, a rising trajectory for public debt, political gridlock, and populist policies on trade in particular. And then if you look on the trade front, there is, of course, the US-China trade war. China has a lot more at stake, I think, and will be more negatively affected by that if things escalate. But it will still be quite significant for the United States as well. It can still wipe out a good chunk out of US economic growth during 2019 or 2020. And it's not the only thing that Donald Trump is doing, right? The US-China trade war is just one part of Donald Trump's trade war. And so sometime this month, we're going to get the other big ticket item, I think, which is the US Commerce Department's report on whether or not the United States should be imposing 25% tariffs on automotive imports, cars and trucks, on the basis that this is a threat to national security. And of course, that sounds silly, but that, if everyone will recall, that was the basis for the steel and aluminium tariffs last year. Now, Trump has indicated that this is pretty overtly a negotiating tactic to try and bludgeon Japan and the EU in their bilateral trade negotiations. So he may, hold off in doing that. But what he said is, as long as I'm happy with how those negotiations are proceeding. So it's not impossible that you could see something like that eventually come through over the coming period. And that would be, in terms of scale of impact, for the global economy, just as big as a US-China full-blown trade war. But for the US economy, because there's a lot more US exports to be retaliated against in that scenario, it could be more damaging for them. So there's at least two big potential shocks coming from the trade angle that could hit the US economy when it's already on a bit of a downswing. And the key thing there is, of course, you've got very limited policy space in terms of the Federal Reserve to respond. They've always got quantitative easing up there, but that is emergency measures. And there's very little fiscal space as well to deal with anything. I mean, everyone's always happy to lend to the United States due to the so-called exorbitant privilege, but things are getting a little bit more dicey on the fiscal front as well. And of course, you have the political gridlock, which can seriously get in the way of a more forceful and timely policy response, because timeliness is always very important for stopping these kinds of things blowing out of proportion. So I think a few risks, and unfortunately, it's going to coincide, for Trump at least, it's going to coincide with when they'll be going back to the polls. On the Chinese economy, I think, there's a few different layers. Certainly there's a lot more bearishness about the Chinese economy. I agree with some of it, but not all of it. I think in terms of current economic conditions, things have definitely softened, but they haven't fallen off a cliff. So yes, China posted some of the slowest growth it's seen at 6.6% last year, which is the slowest pace it's seen in nearly 30 years. And that's just the official rate. The real reality on the ground is probably to be something weaker than that, but not necessarily a heap weaker than that. So it's really a relatively modest slowing. In my view, the US-China trade war is the big threat on the horizon for them. Depending on how far an escalation might go in a negative scenario, it could be a very sizable shock for the Chinese economy. I think under even the worst case scenarios, they can still largely manage. They will respond with a fairly forceful credit stimulus program in response. I think they can get away with that in the short run. It will be bad for the longer term health of the Chinese economy, because it will add to the underlying systemic risks in its financial sector. But I think they can get away with it in the short run. There will probably be a lot of messiness, though, I would imagine, particularly around the exchange rate, which would have implications for global financial markets. I think when you start turning to the longer term, though, I think that's where things start to look more bearish in a sense. I think the evidence is starting to mount in that direction. And I'll just make three points as to why I think that is the case. The first is that the current rate of economic growth is clearly unsustainable because it's reliant on excessive credit growth. So we know definitely the sustainable pace of growth has to be lower than where it is today. The second thing is that there has been some resurgence in the state-owned sector of the economy, which is less efficient than the private side. And to the extent that the state-owned sector is sort of gobbling up more resources in the economy, that's going to be a tax on efficiency. And the further that China goes down in that direction, the worse it will get. And the third thing, which is still playing out, I think, is that, China's working age population is shrinking, right, due to its demographics. And that means in order to post the kind of growth rates it wants to achieve, it needs to rely on fairly rapid productivity growth. Now, if you look at other successful East Asian economies in the past, they've been able to do that even when they were about as rich as China is today. So there's still theoretically a lot of scope for China to post that kind of catch-up growth. But catch-up isn't automatic. And those countries, in order to do that, they were able to employ a very outwardly orientated catch-up development model, outwardly orientated in terms of export-driven, in terms of attracting a lot of foreign investment, and in terms of accessing global knowledge and global technology. On all three of those fronts, you can see that China is now facing pressures. Its export-driven story is already over. And because of the deteriorating relations with the United States and possibly other Western countries, access to foreign investment and global technology is also potentially constrained. So China won't be able to follow that model. It's got an alternative model driven by its own domestic demand and domestic consumption and its own domestic innovation. And because China's economy is big and actually quite innovative, that's a viable model to get some decent productivity gains, but it's still a recipe for slower growth than compared to the other successful East Asian economies. So I think for those three reasons, I think the evidence is starting to lean towards we need to start thinking about taking our expectations for China's long-term growth outlook down a notch or two.
All right, very good. Richard, let me come to you on China. Xi Jinping has a very difficult inbox at the moment. He has a lot of these problems that Roland has mentioned. He's got this complicated relationship with President Trump, and he's got friction in a number of other bilateral relationships. We have the extradition saga of Ms. Meng, who's currently out on bail in Canada. The US Justice Department, I think, foreshadowed charges against her dealing with sanctions violations with Iran. Perhaps in retaliation, or certainly it's highly coincidental, the Chinese have arrested the two Michaels, of course, who are currently in detention, and you and I for the purposes of transparency, both signed that letter to President Xi a couple of weeks ago in relation to the two Michaels. How do you think that little saga might work its way out this year? And more broadly, on the Australia relationship in an election year, how do you think the bilateral relationship might develop?
Well, I guess put the Canada issue in a broader global context, and what you see around the world now, in Western countries in particular, and Western aligned countries in particular, is a big backlash against China. It's been brewing for many years. You can look at many data points to say, you know, why this has come about. IP theft, building islands in the South China Sea, you know, bullying people, this, that, and the other. But you look in Australia, we're an early starter. Canada, Germany, France to some extent, Japan has its particular issues. The US, the biggest of all, Singapore in some respects. There's not only just a concerted pushback against China, but starting to be an organized one. And obviously for China, this is a very, perilous turn of events. That affects Xi in many ways as well. You know, the party secretary, the head of the Communist Party in China, Xi Jinping, he's personally responsible for the bilateral relationship with the US. Now, if you look at the backlash overseas and then look at the backlash internally inside China, underestimated, I think. I'm not saying Xi Jinping is going anywhere or he's going to have to step down or anything like that, but he has a horde of enemies. To start with, from the anti-corruption inquiry, that has made him an enormous number of enemies amongst the elite who've been, lost their entire sort of networks, fortunes, money, families, etc., etc. They're what we might call his bad enemies. You think about his good enemies, there's the technocratic elite who've watched Xi Jinping basically unwind all the sort of incremental institutionalization that's been so successful in China over the past 30 years. They're furious at him as well. And they're also very angry at another issue, and that is one that Roland alluded to, and that is the regrowth of the state in the economy, which they think is a backward step. So he's under more pressure than he's ever been, and he has to make all manner of political decisions. He's got to work out what can the market bear in China in terms of a political settlement or temporary settlement with the US and Trump on trade. He also has to make a political decision about the economy. One of the big issues about the economy in China is setting the target rate. China still does this. And if you set a target rate of 6.5%, then you'll get 6.5%. They say the old joke, China is the only country where GDP is an input, not an output. And So it's going to be very interesting to see in March when they have the National People's Congress when we actually get a target rate. And if the government was gutsy, they would really cut it. I don't think they'll cut it too much because they don't want too much drama. But it's got to be in low sixes, and a really gutsy decision would be under six, because a 6% growth rate, you get a lot of headlines about this saying it's the slowest rate in 20 years, but it's 6% on the current Chinese economy is the same as 10% 10 years ago. 6% is fine. 3 to 4% would be fine if it was good quality growth. So anyway, that's a great issue to watch this year. China's not very transparent. People can't openly criticize Xi Jinping, but look for the signs of pushback at home and abroad. Finally, Australia. Australia, we did have our reset, an official reset towards the end of last year. Speeches by Morrison, a delegation led by John Howard to China for an official track to dialogue. I was on that. And so in theory, Australia and China now are back on a steady path, but it's going to be bumpy. We have to have a relationship which is going to incorporate tensions, because that's what there's going to be.
All right, Ben, there's lots of questions that I could ask you, including about Southeast Asia, which is what you're hired to cover. But seeing as you're the Brit on the panel, I do want to ask you about Brexit. And this will be my final question before I go to the audience. So please have your questions ready. It's just a circus to watch. It's so much fun and yet profoundly dispiriting at the same time, it seems to me, to see a great country, a great liberal democracy sort of consume itself and turn inwards. But anyway, how do you think, what do you think is going to happen this year? We have the big end date coming. We have another flight by Mrs. May on the Spitfire over to Brussels to try to get better terms. What do you think will happen in the short term? And what do you think will happen in the long term to Britain's role in the world as a result of all this introspection?
Well, I'm pleased to see that the Lowy survey shows that 90% of Australians still have faith in the UK, because I'm pretty sure the percentage of British people who have faith in our own government is significantly lower than that right now. So, yeah, I think there are two main issues there, the short term and the long term. In the short term, we're heading to this March 29th deadline by which, by UK law, we will leave the European Union, in at least in theory. But basically what you have behind that is at least a three, if not four, five, six-sided game of chicken, where you have many different factions hoping that they can get what they want, and that by trying to push the whole thing off a cliff, the others will back down in the end. So on the one hand, you have the EU, which says they're not going to reopen any of the withdrawal agreement, which has already been agreed to by May, but rejected by the British Parliament. They're hoping if they just give nothing, in the end, the Brits will have to agree. Then you have the hard Brexiters who say that on March 29th, by law, UK will leave whatever happens. So if we just stop any agreement, we'll get a no-deal Brexit, and thence the sunny, uplit, new world of WTO trade terms, which may not be as rosy as they say. But anyway, that's what they want. And then you have kind of the hardcore Remainers and second referendum people who want another vote, and preferably the public to give the right answer, as they would see it this time. And they hope, again, if they can push a mess, they can somehow get no deal off the table, because that would collapse the economy. And then the only thing left to do if Parliament can't agree is ask the people, and yeah, hopefully they'll give the right answer. So everyone is hoping that the other side gives way at the last minute. And of course, in many previous EU negotiations, if you looked at what happened with Greece and the IMF, in the end, it came down to the last minute, and then deadlines were extended. There were further referenda, which leads me on to the bigger picture. And I think it's important for people to understand that what is being negotiated or not negotiated now is the withdrawal agreement. This is only about how the UK leaves the EU. But the future relationship, which in many ways is the far more important part of this, that sets out what Britain's role will be with its nearest trading partners, its nearest security allies for the next decades and centuries, that hasn't even been discussed yet. And I think whatever happens, we're not going to have any clarity after March the 29th. This is going to hang over the UK for years, and if not decades, trying to resolve all these fiendishly complex relationships. And I guess the biggest concern a lot of people have about that is that it's just a massive distraction from the ability of the government to deal with the many problems Britain has at home, similar to Australia, high housing prices, widening inequality, as well as some of the sort of future economic issues for the UK. And this is just going to become a massive distraction for years and years and years. And unfortunately, that's what it looks like. And that's the one thing about which very few people disagree, that there is no solution in sight.
There's not a huge amount of bandwidth in London to discuss matters other than Brexit. And I remember just a couple of months ago I was in London and I was talking to a very senior official, and we'd been talking about Brexit, and I said, well, you know, what else is on, you know, what else are you working on in the world? And there was this sort of pause, and I could see the gears moving in his head, because he clearly had not thought about almost anything other than Brexit for months. And like I said, I mean, it's only my take on it, but I think having a strong international order and a strong Western bloc requires an outward-looking Britain, and I think it's going to be a long time till we have that again. Anyway, here endeth the lesson. We have about 20 minutes, a bit less than 20 minutes for questions, so I'm going to go to as many people as I can. So to cover, there are lots of issues we haven't discussed, so apologies for that, and we'll try to get into it in the Q&A. Start with Jeff Miller. Just wait for the mic, Jeff, and after Jeff, if everyone could give us their name and any affiliation before they ask their question.
China watchers, thinking about what might be significant in relation to China in the coming year, mentioned Taiwan, the possibility of a clash or a crisis over Taiwan. I really don't know on what they based those comments. I wonder if you could say something about it.
I personally don't see it. You know, the Chinese military, they budget for it, they train for it, they war game it, you know, invading Taiwan, they have for years. Their capabilities continue to get more powerful very quickly. But I think there's a couple of things. Obviously, we've got a sort of independence-leaning or autonomous-leaning government in Taiwan that naturally turns up the temperature in Beijing, which we've seen happen. Secondly, you've always got your hawks in China who talk about this and want it to be resolved. But I think at the end of the day, people realize it's not so easy. It's a really difficult problem for China, Taiwan. In any kind of military conflict is a potential disaster, even if you win, depending on how long it takes you to win, whether you can win before the Americans get there and all that. That's, you know, amphibious landings, that's difficult. And I wonder whether many people in China realize that even once you win militarily, then the problems really start, because you've got to occupy an island which doesn't want you there. I certainly think that China has a lot of anniversaries coming up. They always do. 2021 is the anniversary, I think, of the founding of the Communist Party, 100 years anniversary. Some people say, oh, this is a little present for Xi Jinping, we'll get Taiwan. I don't see anything like that happening for 10 years, because it's simply too risky, and there's too much of a downside for China on so many levels. So you might see a lot more pressure, the Chinese bully pulpit, hurting the Taiwanese economy, etc., etc. But we have another Taiwan presidential election coming up reasonably soon, the KMT, sort of pro-China party, so to speak, or pro-unification party, I should say. Anti-CCP, pro-unification party did quite well, or better than expected. So we might get back into the cycle of waiting for another election as to the sort of the big picture invasion scenario. Famous last words, I say no.
All right, I saw this gentleman's hand next, and then the lady in the second row.
Hi, I'm Arya. I think we might be missing one big issue. It's about the world security issue. Bulletin atomic of scientists turn the clock hand, doomsday clock, to 2 minutes. It closed to midnight. So the reason is a combination. It's about Trump's great space force, is the cyber warfare. Second, Trump announced they already produced a nuclear bomb that have a low yield, and they said they will use it. This is the Third World War, if you use it. And another one is about the withdrawal from INF Treaty. That will be armless around the world, the big one. So you feel safe? I ask you, I don't think so.
That's a very good question. We don't have our international security program director on the stage. Is there anyone who wants to, maybe I'm looking at Richard on the cyber warfare side, but should we be feeling safe at this moment?
Look, I'm not an expert. I mean, the INF, what happened with the INF treaty the other day and the abrogation of it or withdrawal, threatened withdrawal, I'm not an expert on that, and it's a highly arcane area. But I would say what's happened with Russia and the US is a function of the much larger geopolitical split or the revival of great power competition. China, of course, is siding with Russia, but there are many Americans who say that China should be part of this, and they've been able to build up their warheads because they haven't been part of the this agreement. But yes, it is very worrying, but I'm not an expert on an area which requires genuine expertise.
I think the other point to make, and perhaps it's one of Mr. Trump's only saving graces, is that he's not actually a Dr. Strangelove character in the sense that, unlike some other recent American presidents and senior officials, he's not promiscuous in terms of the use of force. I mean, one thing about President Trump is he's really only used force on a couple of limited occasions in the airstrikes against the al-Shayrat base in Syria. If you look at his writings over the last 30 or 40 years, he usually opposes significant use of force by the United States on pretty dubious grounds, like what does that have to do with us? But nevertheless, that is a sort of something of a check on US behavior. I don't think you're going to see from Mr. Trump, an attempt to impose America's will on a part of the world, as we saw in the Bush administration, which can lead to tensions. However, the flip side of that is that if he were faced with a challenge from, say, the Kremlin, whether he would have the sort of intestinal fortitude or the desire to stand up to aggressive behaviour from another player in defence of a third-party ally in the Baltics, for example, is not at all clear to me. So it might be, I mean, to answer your question, do I feel safe? I don't like what's happened with the INF treaty. I personally don't think that Mr. Trump is a trigger-happy president, but there are other ways of bringing danger to the world than being trigger-happy, and one of them is not being prepared to stand up for rules, not being prepared to stand up to bullies. And unfortunately, Mr. Trump doesn't believe in rules and he quite likes bullies. So that doesn't make me feel safe, if I can answer your question that way. Can I go to the lady in the second row, please?
Thank you. It's Liz Beock from the International Commission of Jurists. I was quite concerned by some news I got last week from a colleague in Timor-Leste that the American Department of Defense are assisting the government of East Timor in redeveloping a large airport and base in the north coast of the state. This will be the only airport in eastern Indonesia, in that part of Southeast Asia and the Pacific, that can take large military planes. Can we draw from this perhaps that the United States is looking at a greater presence in Southeast Asia, the Asia Pacific? And if that's so, what does it mean in terms of the South China Sea, the tensions and all the ongoing issues that you've alluded to?
Ben, I'm looking at you.
I don't know the details of that particular base, but I think actually the perception in Southeast Asia is much the other way. I think a lot of people are afraid about the US withdrawing from the region, not necessarily militarily, but in terms of its overall engagement diplomatically, economically. We saw the withdrawal of the US from the TPP, now CPTPP, without the US involved. And generally, there was a sense, even before Trump, that the Obama administration had not really fleshed out the meat of the pivot, the rebalance, as it was rebranded later on, and actually not much really changed on the ground. So I don't think there's a fear of more US meddling. There's the other way around, a concern in some countries that the US is losing its focus, and that may not be just a Trump issue. And I guess Richard can speak about this in more detail, but there's a fear that this is a sort of secular trend of the US turning more inward that started before Trump and will continue after him. So I don't see those concerns about US intervention. It's the other way around.
I wonder whether it might be a Chinese base being built there, and whether would you have the same concerns, or would it be a different set of concerns? Because so it could be both or all of the above.
I feel sure that President Trump wasn't, if a decision has been taken, I feel sure that he was not consulted, because it's probably not his he would be asking, why are we bothering at this other end of the world? So I saw this gentleman here, and then I saw Aaron Patrick from the AFR, and I saw this lady in the second row. So, sir?
Thanks very much. Greg Holland from the Speyside Group. I suppose to you, Ben, the relationship between Indonesia and Australia, regardless of who wins the election, and presume it is the incumbent, if then also we assume that Labor wins the federal election here, do you think there's going to be a change in the relationship between Australia and Indonesia, given that a number of shadow ministers, I understand it, have taken a big interest in Indonesia over the last couple of years by making a lot of visits there, and indeed some of them have learnt to speak the language, including the shadow treasurer, Chris Bowen?
I'll ask Ben to have a go, but then I'll ask Alex to chime in as well on Australia-Indonesia relations.
Yeah, I won't talk too much about the new government as someone who's only just arrived in Australia. I'll leave that to the Australians. But I do think, in general...
If there is a new government.
Yeah, if there is a new government. But there will be a new government,
whoever is elected.
Right? I think the Australia-Indonesian relationship will probably continue in its current form where... You know, people are looking for ways to engage more, but it's quite hard to find alignment. And there are these persistent crises that keep propping up. I think on both sides, there are sort of insecurities and, you know, different groups, the media, politicians in both countries know how to play on these insecurities to sort of rile people up. But generally speaking, I think, you know, Australia will be about as important an issue in Indonesia's election as Indonesia will be in your election here. So probably not much either way. In terms of the political issue now, but later on, I think, you know, there's hope that engagement can go deeper, but it's very hard when, you know, the countries are so different in terms of how they're run, the mentality, and how the people see each other.
The round of speeches that I mentioned towards the end of last year were quite interesting in the emphasis they put on the Pacific and the lack of emphasis they put on Indonesia, considering the size and the importance of that relationship. In a public opinion sense, you know, Australians are not very literate about Indonesia, they're not literate about Asia generally, and there are lots of misconceptions and stereotypes about the relationship. When we asked in 2015 whether Australians admired Indonesian President Joko Widodo, 47% were actually unable to answer that question, despite the coverage at the time of the election and the fact that he was quite an appealing new candidate. There's a paucity of coverage on the relationship, but at the most basic level, Australians do appreciate that this is an important relationship. So it was a bit surprising. Scott Morrison made two foreign policy speeches towards the end of last year in late November. Senator Penny Wong made an important speech, in fact, one here and one in Melbourne on the new government's, a Labor government's foreign policy. And Bill Shorten made a speech here at the Institute on Foreign Policy. And there were almost no references to Indonesia at all. There was a glancing reference by Scott Morrison to the RCEP, the trade agreement that you mentioned, now that any free trade agreement prospects seem to have receded in the Australia-Indonesia context, largely because of that thorny Jerusalem embassy issue. Penny Wong referred to our diplomatic presence in Asia and perhaps a new embassy or mission in Indonesia. And Bill Shorten referred to the strategic trust that Keating established, or that Keating referred to as wanting Australia to establish with Indonesia, and he promised an early visit to Jakarta. So I would say that that interest in Australia, in Australian foreign policy, is quite muted, or certainly there's a demonstration. The demonstration by our politicians is quite muted.
Aaron Patrick.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks for a fantastic function. I don't know if anyone on the panel will be able to answer this, but
I had a question preceded with that kind of comment.
Sorry, anyway. Terrible way to open the question. You know, there is one very big difference between the Australian parties, which is offshore detention. And I'd be fascinated to know if the panel has any view about the morality of keeping the asylum seekers and refugees on Manus and Nauru, and whether it's good policy.
All right, and I might take, while everyone's absorbing that, I might take the other question from the lady in the second row, and then I'll go to the panel and give them an opportunity to speak on both.
I think the question is based on, do you feel safe? I guess it's just wanting to answer that question. I'm Zoe from the Fiji Consular and Trade Commission, and doing work in the Pacific with my colleagues and listening to Maurice Payne speak earlier about cyber terrorism and space a few weeks ago. I do feel safe, but I think that economically that's driven by fear, and diplomacy, we see it's about negotiation and threats. And I would say that with Jacinta Ardern recently come out and talk about a well-being budget, we also have the four big banks that lost $68 billion over the past year. I think it's more based on, are we looking too much at greed and not looking at people's well-being? Like, there's maybe too much of a focus on GDP. Is there going to be a shift at all? Do you see that in the forecast for your year ahead?
All right. Who wants to have a crack, first of all, on asylum seekers? Alex, you can tell. Alex can tell us a bit about Australian public opinion on it.
So mean. who asked that question? Look, in terms of public opinion, there is pretty much an even divide. Australians have been in the past, according to our own polling, firmly supportive of Operation Sovereign Borders, as it was then called when we polled about this in 2014. They've been relatively divided on the merits of offshore detention. And we took a second poll on a question that was specifically related to that, where there seemed to be a slight softening, but only marginal. So I'd say you see the population split right down the middle on whether this is the right or wrong policy. When we asked Australians 2 years ago, on whether asylum seekers should be settled in Australia or should never be settled in Australia again, there was pretty much a dead heat. So it's a really difficult policy from a public perception point of view and from managing Australians' expectations and desires. On political partisanship, there doesn't seem to be much of a divide there. On the morality of it, that is not for me to say. I can only see what the political responses have been to an incredibly difficult question. This week, of course, in Parliament, we are going to see the coalition government trying to get up its Medivac, a medical assessment policy, and that seems to be in anticipation of a Labor Party move, or in fact it's Karen Phelps, isn't it, who's proposing a Medivac policy. So it seems that they are going to be on similar pages when it comes to assessment of medical needs of asylum seekers offshore. I don't think the Labor Party is going to move towards any major shift in what we have come to call our border protection policy.
Richard, did you want to come in on that?
I really dislike that word immoral. It's like, I remember if you frame things like that, when Kevin Rudd described the climate change as the greatest moral challenge of our generation, how do you ever live up to that? How do you defend anything that's immoral? I think you can criticise the policy. You don't need that sort of detention as a deterrent. The pushing back the boats is enough. The idea that if we no longer have offshore detention, then immediately, and we get these stories in the press like this, obviously pushed out by the coalition, that the market for asylum seekers immediately opens up like a shop in Indonesia or something like that, and all the boats start leaving again. And it's the whole horrible way the debate is framed on either side. And Labor runs scared of it because they think they're going to lose the election if they don't sort of appear just as tough. And that's one reason why we're in the position we are now, because of the Rudd policy. So I think you can be against the policy because it's not necessary. It's excessively expensive. It poisons relations with PNG and Nauru, and frames relations with the Pacific in that respect when we have other interests in the Pacific, and continues this endless, dry, horrible cycle of this issue in politics, where we talk about it to the detriment of so many other issues. But I won't say it's immoral.
You wanted to add something? Yeah, just 10 seconds.
Quick observations. Yep. Interestingly, yesterday, the Indonesia head of the International Organisation for Migration said Australia must continue with its boat turn back policy because that is critical to stemming the flow of asylum seekers from Indonesia. And secondly, it's actually quite a low-order concern amongst Australians when you look at it. There was very favourable support for Operation Sovereign Borders, but when you rank that amongst Australians' other concerns, it is a pretty low-order concern. There's only about 40% of Australians who see immigration and the flow of refugees into Australia, which is how it's been phrased for years in our polling, as being a significant concern to Australia. So perhaps the political assessment of how much blowback there would be should there be a policy change is actually inflated.
Roland, can I ask you, as an economist, are we moving towards different measures? I think the questioner was asking, are we moving to different measures? Do you see GDP fading as the main sort of marker of the size of countries' economies, or what do you see on that?
It's always an interesting question. I mean, I like GDP in some sense, right? But what I'll say, I think the issue is that I think you know the conversation gets too dominated with the idea of replacing GDP, where instead of saying what is GDP useful for and asking where is it not useful for, what is it not useful for, right? So it's very useful for a range of economic questions around the size of the economy, when trying to do the budget, trying to measure productivity, all that sort of stuff. You need that measure. Can you get another measure which comprehensively better measures living standards and people's well-being? Probably. Would it actually be useful for designing any policies? Probably not. So I think it's a much better idea to just accept what GDP is and accept that it's not useful for a lot of other things, and look at a much broader range of variables that do capture how people's well-being, from morbidity to life expectancy, education levels, all that sort of thing. It's called the dashboard approach, and that's the approach that I think is usually much better.
10 seconds, yes, Ben.
Okay, if I could just comment, I think there is a political dimension to economic security as well that GDP doesn't capture, because if you look at Indonesia or other countries in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of talk about the growing middle class, but a lot of people are actually living on the fringes of poverty, going in and out all the time, and they feel incredibly insecure, and that their prospects aren't captured by these big debates about the growth figures. And that is a direct political issue, because people are asking, are the governments, is even the political system, is democracy able to deliver the fundamental sort of economic goods to make people feel safe? And that's actually much more important to many people than what's happening in the South China Sea.
Let me say, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's been a terrific discussion. We've talked about morality. We've tried to make an economist step back from his life's work. We've tackled some, not all, but some of the big issues this year. Let me say, it's going to be a cracker of a year for the Institute. We have a new Lowy Institute paper by Richard McGregor on China. We have a number of big speakers already scheduled. We have the versions 2.0 of our two big data-driven digital projects from last year, the Pacific Aid Map. We didn't talk a lot about the Pacific today, but the Pacific Aid Map by Jonathan and Alexandra, which measures aid flows from all countries to the Pacific. We'll be launching the second edition of that, second edition of the Asia Power Index, which we launched last year in New York with Mr. Rudd, which measures the power of different Asian states. And of course, to finish where I started, we have an election year, and we'll have many, many things going on at the Institute to try to draw out politicians on some of these issues, whether it's debates or speeches or analysis by Lowy Institute experts. The last thing to say is that this will be our last year at number 1 Bligh Street. As many of you know, we are currently refurbishing our beautiful historic headquarters at 31 Bligh Street, where we lived for the first 10 years of our existence. And we'll have an announcement a little bit later in the year, but sometime this year, in the second half of the year, we will be moving back to 31 Bligh Street, and look forward to welcoming you there. Let me finish by saying the metaphor that will stick in my head is Ben Bland describing Brexit as a 4 or 5-way game of chicken. And I'm just trying to imagine the squawks and the flying feathers. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us.